Hi to our podcast audience and to our online listeners. While we know you are listening, it really helps when you take a moment to subscribe. The more subscribers, the greater reach. It's super easy. Go to lauraflanders.org/listen. There are direct links to the many platforms where you can subscribe. And for all our lovely fans, please consider putting that love into action by becoming a member. We're independent from corporations and government, but we are dependent on you. Go to patreon.com/theLF Show and become a member. Members receive special bonus content, and we've got some great stuff coming up. Help us get a jump on reaching our goal of 100 patrons by the end of the year. Recruit, recruit. We're over halfway there. Now on with this week's show. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is The Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real-life models of shifting power from the few to the many in the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, and governance. Gender-based violence. Why are states so bad at making it stop? Maybe it has to do with the money they get for perpetuating it. This week, in her first appearance since fleeing Brazil, a woman's rights advocate speaks, and we talk with activists and philanthropists about what works and what doesn't when it comes to stopping violence against women and girls. That's all coming up on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. Gender-based violence happens everywhere. It undermines the health, dignity, security, and autonomy of its victims. It knows no social, economic, or national limits. Violence against women and girls and anyone perceived as vulnerable on the basis of their gender is as old as the hills. Even as year after year, decade after decade, governments and non-governmental organizations alike pledge to stop it. Is it possible that a lot of well-funded efforts just don't work? Might they even be counterproductive? It's possible. But as they say, there is hope. Somehow, against all odds, some of the most vulnerable people in the world are doing some pretty effective work. Here to talk about the problem and the possible solutions are Kavita N. Ramdas. After years of foundation work, as well as activism, she knows the world of philanthropy from the inside and out. She currently heads up the Women's Rights Program at the Open Society Foundations. Terry McGovern directs the Program on Global Health Justice and Governance at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. She's just back from a fact-finding visit to Beirut. Deborah Denise is Deputy Director of the Rights and Justice Unit for the International Planned Parenthood Federation, Western Hemisphere region. She was recently driven into exile after receiving death threats in her home in Brazil. Thank you all for coming in, and I particularly appreciate you, Deborah, for being willing to talk on the program. Just to clarify for people, why did you leave Brazil? What are you up against? When did it start? And what was the nature of the threats that you've been facing?
To understand what is happening with me, we need to understand who is the new president of Brazil. So Bolsonaro is his name, and in place since last January. And when we talk about Trump, we need to think that Trump is Bolsonaro from the South. It's the other way around. So he made his career making misogynists, racists, and against human rights defenders. So it was just a matter of time that I was in the center of a human rights issue to decriminalize abortion in Brazil. Abortion is against the law, women go to jail, and I was in leading a movement to change the legislation at the Supreme Court. So it was a coincidence last year when he started his race to the presidency, and they started to send me death threats.
So to put a point on it, you happen to be working on this work of decriminalizing as the Bolsonaro campaign is heating up.
Yeah. Yes.
So death threats start coming.
So I'm described as the first exiled person from Brazil, but my point is that it's just the number one, because human rights is at the center of his battle. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural battle against democracy, and there is a core agenda that is anti-women, anti-gender, anti-LGBT populations. So in my case, I have this sensitive issue from many people that is abortion, but I mean, it's not putting women in jail. It's about that in the South. And I was leading that case. So I was a face in the public space.
And what was the nature of the threats, if you don't mind me asking, and who did they come from?
Yeah, it's really scary because it was against me, my husband, my family, and they didn't stop. So even not being in Brazil anymore, I keep receiving them. And it's a mix of concrete description of how they will kill me, my parents, my brothers, my sisters, my husband, but also I would say in a language just saying, I know where you are working now. Mm-hmm. We know where you live now. Mm-hmm. So at the same time that you can say, it's just to put you in fear. Mm-hmm. It's just to paralyze you.
Mm-hmm. Did you have qualms about coming on the show?
I consulted the police before coming here. I consulted a group of lawyers. And it's the first time that I'm speaking in public about that.
You have a hypothesis, Terry, about why violence on the basis of gender continues to be both so rampant, so deadly, and at the same time, so funded, kind of. Talk about it a little bit. And what took you to Beirut?
So first I want to say that it's just thank you for having us, but also I just want to express incredible respect for Deborah. You find people like her all throughout the world working on gender-based violence. So although we're going to say a lot of kind of complex, difficult things, there's also incredible hope in these women all throughout the world and girls who are doing this work. So you are a big example of that. So I think that, you know, patriarchy is very complicated. It's laws, it's culture, it's manipulation of all kinds of things. And there's been kind of a tendency from donors to kind of land on education is the answer or economic opportunity is the answer.
Often, those are the answers.
Exactly. Often ignoring kind of the structural factors that are affecting women and girls. So when you begin to look at what's being funded, first of all, if you're partnering, if you're funding through many governments, then you're not going to be funding efforts to change laws.
Why so? Explain.
Because the UN is basically their client is the government, right? So that makes it very difficult to do things that are going to be difficult for the government. So in many countries, you have big problems with law, personal status law, religious law, and it's at the core of kind of some of the issues that are going on. So if you just go in and give the girl education, or you just go in and give her a cash transfer.
Or a micro loan.
Right. It's not fixing the larger set of issues. So I think there are some very courageous donors who are actually trying to get at this now and figure out how do we address complex interacting dynamics that produce gender-based violence. We haven't seen a decrease. In fact, it's worse and worse. So it is really important to look at what are we spending on? Why aren't we seeing changes? How do we empower people like Deborah on the ground who have amazing ideas? What is blocking them from getting resources?
All right, so Kavita, you've worked in many of these foundations. You're working at another one now. Agree, disagree, add?
Actually, I would distinguish foundations from the biggest source of quote-unquote aid internationally is not from foundations at all, actually. It comes from what we call bilateral or multilateral aid. So it is government-to-government transfers or government-to-multi-government institutions like the UN transfers. Mm-hmm. And those are much larger in terms of total amounts. And actually, there is where Terry's point about some indications of change. Most recently, the Dutch government made a series of investments in women's funds. Feminist funds and women's funds were created by women, the first one in the United States in 1972, the Ms. Foundation for Women by Gloria Steinem and others, because in fact they saw that mainstream philanthropy was not not putting money directly into the hands of small grassroots organizations. I worked for 14 years at the Global Fund for Women, and it also was created as a response to the fact that, in fact, many times the kinds of support that an ANIS, which is the organization Deborah leads in, led and founded in Brazil, don't and can't absorb $50,000 or $250,000, but may need $10,000, may need $20,000, and may need it in ways that don't limit them from being able to use it in the ways that they think are important. So I think the first thing I'd say is that when you can recognize that the best way in which to get resources into the hands of activists on the ground is to actually use a much more democratic means of philanthropy than what we currently have, which is a very small number of primarily white men who have made fortunes through an extremely unjust and unequal economic system. If they remain in control of those resources, then no matter how wonderful an individual program officer would be, and Terry and I both worked prior to this at the Ford Foundation, we need to be able to work with allies in a different vision.
And we believe in trickle-up funds and trickle-up justice and all of that. But what I'm hearing from you, Terry, and from you, Deborah, is if you don't address the superstructure in which these groups are working, you could do fantastic work, have fantastic funding, and still be driven out of the country by
absolutely
death threats, right? So what would be your request? What might have made your situation different, Deborah?
I think that we have to make a balance here. What is happening in Latin America in general, it's a kind of lab as a response for two things I would reduce here. One is a populist wave in the globe. It's not just here, but it's Latin America is a lab also because of the response to the foundation's decisions in the last decade, when we heard that Latin America was not a priority to global aid or to global philanthropy, because we were in a good position. And Brazil was a key example of that. It's almost a continent, and we heard that we are not a priority anymore because they're mid-level in country in development. And it's that, it's a response from inside. Mm-hmm. And we are in a region that, with all respect to religions, we have a colonization of evangelicals and Catholics in power. So at the core of our discussion connected to where the money goes, we need a discussion about democracy.
I actually had a chance to interview the opposition to Bolsonaro, who said the U.S. was not unconnected to the growth, especially of Pentecostal presence in Brazil.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. We're talking about gender-based violence and why it's so hard to stop. My guests grapple with this question every day. Deborah Denise from Brazil is a bioethicist who led a campaign for reproductive rights as human rights in the wake of the Zika virus. She was driven into exile because of threats from the right after the election of President Jair Bolsonaro. Kavita Ramdas, formerly CEO of the Global Fund for Women, directs the Women's Rights Program at the Open Society Foundations. And Terry McGovern is a longtime activist around AIDS and health law, and she's director of the Program on Global Health Justice and Governance at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. If you appreciate this complex conversation about gender, race, rights, and power at the heart of a seemingly obvious wrong, gender violence, and value this sort of anti-tweet programming, then subscribe at lauraflanders.org/listen or through your favorite podcast app. Subscribe, rate, and review this show, and you'll be sharing the word with your networks, something that only you can do. And in return, we'll send you bonus content, audio shorts, musical playlists, and my research materials. Next, how do you stop violence where women have yet to have basic human rights under law, or confront companies that launch anti-violence publicity campaigns while they're still exploiting women workers? While you're thinking about that, here's 'Cause I'm a Woman by Muted Soul, featuring Jess King, courtesy of Muted Records. No mistake I ever made could be worth half the price I paid. See you finally.
You were just back from Beirut. Why? And why are you looking at Beirut and, well, Lebanon and Tunisia as your two sort of tests?
So that's actually just the place we're starting because we have a lot of work there already. I mean, just to say, you see the evangelical presence
everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to not, I was just in Kenya and...
But it doesn't just magically appear, I guess is the point.
No, but I mean, it's across
India, yeah. It's in Haiti. It is a huge and growing presence.
And they're mobilizing on everything, right? Not just, against abortion. They're mobilizing against human rights, democracy, and
what they call gender ideology.
So
we did a show about just recently.
So they will be there. Beirut or Lebanon has a personal status law. So women and girls, they can't get divorced. So how do you talk about a strategy around gender-based violence where you still don't have basic rights around control? And that's an example where, there have been amazing campaigns and a lot of victories, but Lebanon right now has a Syrian refugee crisis. It's had a Palestinian refugee crisis. They're overrun with, talk about where is the money, they're overrun by the humanitarian sector coming in to study or provide relief, but are they going to provide safe abortions to women and girls who experience sexual violence? These issues are all so connected. You can't talk about gender-based violence and not talk about abortion, access to contraception, your rights to get divorced.
Your rights in the workplace.
Right, exactly. Obviously, Beirut is a very interesting example, long history of activism. It is caught in this kind of global situation, this refugee crisis. It's overrun by some new donors who don't know anything about the context. So that's a really important point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't say this works in this country and then slap it into another country. No. You can't use a toolkit for gender-based violence that's going to work everywhere. And I think that's what some of the funding has been reduced to. Not all of it. You're absolutely right. There's brilliant small donors, but...
I mean, you can see why people say we have to just quickly do whatever it takes to get people out of immediate threat situation. If we have to work with the government to get those refugees into a safe place, we will. I mean, you can see why people take that approach.
Of course, but I just want to go back to something Deborah mentioned about this kind of whole middle-income country nonsense, which is a classic thing, like, oh, now countries are in middle-income status, we don't need to worry about them. We just fought and won... women's movements globally, a battle that was fought in a middle to high income country, namely Ireland. The women's rights program at the Open Society Foundation was able to support the campaign for Yes over a 3-year period with small grants to be able to help women organizing. And Ireland is not a poor country, but we knew that actually if there wasn't support, and it was interesting because we really found ourselves the sole supporter of that work because so many people said, well, this is not Africa, this is not India. But if that fight had not been fought, the repercussions for many Catholic countries all over the world and many non-Catholic countries would have been profound. And so I think Deborah's point for us certainly as private philanthropy, to take a step back and to see that there may be opportunities in the so-called middle-income countries to actually fight and win battles that actually have the potential then to have a huge impact in other parts of the world. And I hope more of us can begin to step up around
point. Those. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is most of these countries are not middle-income women's countries. I mean,
Thank you. Yes.
who's getting this middle income here? So go back to some of the models that are working. I mean, I'd love to hear from all of you, but you've just come back, Terry. If you had your druthers, what would you see philanthropy, aid, all of us do in a situation like Beirut?
Well, I mean, I think it's just embrace complexity. Don't look for a single strategy, right? Don't just say, we're going to focus on this. And then, because that's what happens in philanthropy.
2 years on women.
Right.
3 years on girls.
No, we've decided it's economic opportunity. No, we've decided it's education. Right. No, we've decided it's cash transfers. And everybody moves over to that.
The point being the we've decided part?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a little bit of a pile-on when the big donors decide this is the strategy we're going to follow. Yeah. And I just think it's a mix of strategies for sure. And the point about it being tied to democracy is critical.
Yeah, but I would add, besides knowing that it's complexity, embracing questions that we do not have all the answers, but is also questioning where the experts are based, here or there. So it's a feminist shift that we need in our philanthropy. But sometimes you cannot even talk about gender. Some countries, you cannot talk about gender at the universities anymore.
They've been closing down gender studies programs.
Can you imagine?
Across Eastern Europe, across, it's really ironic, at the Open Society Foundations, the first women's rights program was funding gender studies programs in the former Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And now many countries across Eastern Europe are closing down gender studies programs because they feel that it is promoting an anti-family ideology. One concern I have around the unwillingness to embrace complexity, and I recently was talking to someone in the business world, you know. So now you see Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Unilever and ExxonMobil and all these companies, they all want to quote-unquote empower girls and sometimes empower girls and women. But I think the question around that is when you, on the one hand, are paying workers a pittance in your for-profit company, and on the other hand, you're running a program to empower them, to teach them about being beaten up at home. Women can see through that in a heartbeat. You know, you talk to the International Domestic Workers Federation, and they will tell you, where are all these companies to stand up for decent wages for women? So that is also a form of violence, which I think we don't often... People like to think about violence in kind of very neat little boxes. And what they don't understand is there is economic violence being perpetrated on women all the time.
Gender washing won't fly.
Yes.
To come back, I'm thinking of a wonderful mentor I had for many years, Vivian Stromberg, who was one of the founders of MADRI. Yes. I know you're on the board, familiar with this organization that worked with women in Central America during the period of the Central American Wars. She would say... Yeah, we're stopping violence against women and girls. We're for empowerment. But sometimes on the ground, that meant digging a well or helping somebody buy a truck.
That's the complexity.
So if we were to say, where did that $50 go in the campaign against violence against women and girls, where would they put it?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yes, totally. It's the standards emanating from the global north, frankly, is one issue. And then secondly, it's going to be a whole bunch of different areas that need to be impacted, that are in play. And they've been like, oh, well, that's humanitarian, and this is gender-based violence, and this is development, and that's human rights, and it's just not working.
So give us an example from your most recent trip in terms of the innovations coming from the ground or the compromises and complexity of the work on the ground.
Well, I mean, there are amazing groups that want to really take on this personal status law. They need funding for a flexible, resourceful campaign that takes from the work in Ireland, that looks at what has been successful. They don't want to just work on early marriage or just work on, you know, the six things you can choose from. They actually want to figure it out as they go and have the flexibility and funding to amend the strategy. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, things are very dynamic.
Yeah, and I have a very good example also, and it was sponsored by Open Society and IPPF. When Zika arrived, International Planned Parenthood Federation, the Western Hemisphere, where I'm now based. So when Zika, the epidemic of Zika virus arrived in Latin America, it was, of course, at the center of the discussion, the mosquito. Not the women. So the mosquito. It was a big mosquito and saying risk. So we took some time to say we need to put women and girls at the center of our conversation.
Yes.
Because talking about reproductive rights is talking about public health. So we need to reframe everything. But we need also to build an ecosystem mindset to change the way that we worked. Because if that woman decided to have the baby, you know, talking about choices.
Yeah.
We need to make a connection with the disability movement.
Yes.
We need to talk about social protection. Exactly. We need to talk about transportation. We need to talk about cash benefit transfer. And we need to talk about abortion. Yeah. So different communities that traditionally do not talk to each other. Because those who sponsor disability groups, generally speaking, they are faith-based groups.
Yeah.
So how to manage changing the way that we work with groups?
So how do we manage, particularly in a media culture, which, as you're saying all of this, I'm thinking this exact same problem exists in the media. We have niche coverage, women over here and children over here, disability
right.
over here. Mostly we talk about politicians, but not as they relate to any of those, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Laura, you'll be amused. I've been on a bit of a tear inside the foundation recently talking about how we think about intersectional gender justice. And I've been told in a couple of meetings, oh, you're using jargon. And my polite response is, you know, we've been using the jargon of men for some 3,000 years now. You can learn how to use the word intersectional. And this is all that it means. It means this, what we've been talking about, which is Audre Lorde put it beautifully. She said, we don't live single issue lives. So how could we have single issue movements? And I would add, how can we have single issue funding? It is not possible for those of us who have experienced life in communities to say that a woman who is experiencing a disease caused by a mosquito is not also a woman who is struggling with unfair wages, or a woman who is not struggling with lack of access to healthcare, or a woman who isn't struggling with perhaps intimate partner violence. And I think it is when we stop being willing to hold that complexity, which Derry pointed out, that then we get into trouble. I mean, I was recently talking to Lydia Alpizar, who runs the association, Mesoamerican Initiative for Women Human Rights Defenders. And she gave a painful example of how mainstream human rights protection organizations fail to bring a gender lens to their work. So they had picked up a woman from Honduras to save her from the violence she was experiencing as a women human rights defender in Honduras. They picked her up and they took her to Spain with her family, but failed to realize that she was also a victim of unbelievable violence. She was murdered by her husband 2 months after they arrived in Spain.
Terry, we often ask people on the show, what will be the story the future tells of this moment?
I think we are getting smarter and much more strategic. And if we allow the women and girls at the country level to lead, and we use our best brains, we can figure this out. But a key piece of it is the donor piece. But there's many other pieces. I always feel a lot of hope, but things need to change.
Fast. And
yes.
Terry, Deborah, Kavita, thank you all so much. You give me hope, for sure.
Thank you.
That was Terry McGovern, professor and chair of population and family health at Columbia University Medical Center, Kavita Ramdas, director of the Women's Rights Program at the Open Society Foundations, and Deborah Denise, deputy director of the Rights and Justice Unit for the International Planned Parenthood Federation Western Hemisphere Region. You can find more information about all of my guests and links to shows on similar topics like gender ideology, which has become a kind of pretext for murder in Brazil, and an exclusive with Deborah Denise, her first public interview since fleeing her country with her family. You'll also find additional research materials and related links at patreon.com/theLF Show. That's patreon.com/TheLF Show. This show is independent and ad-free thanks to our listeners and viewers like you. Want to be part of our support base? Please join us at lauraflanders.org. This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, with Monica Mohapatra, Charlotte Carpenter, Nat Needham, Natasha Gaspar, Jeannie Hopper, Joanna Pinto, and Dominic Marcella. The Laura Flanders Show is made possible from the Novo, Ford, Tomcat, Cloud Mountain, and Fonda Foundations, as well as by listeners like you. So thank you. Stay kind, stay curious. Until the next time, I'm Laura.